Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 25th day of Cheshvan. Thank you, OU. Thank you, Rabbi Jacob Bramowitz. Thank you, David Hochhauser, for helping us with putting these shiurim online so that they can be available and we can learn Torah together. Today, we're going to see two tshuvot, relatively brief ones, but they're both by Tzitz Eliezer, and they're both from the same year, the 25th of Cheshvan. They're around the 25th of Cheshvan of Tufshin Mem Dalid of 1983, and they both deal with very similar kinds of issues from Haifa, about marriages going wrong and claims being made against women and showing Tzitz Eliezer was in an appeals court. He was like in a higher level Beit Din, so an irur, an appeal came to him, and we're going to see at the very end for Ravad Yosef as well, about a husband and wife who were divorcing, and there were claims made about the wife's conduct in each case, where the husband made negative claims about the wife's conduct. And part of what's interesting to me about the Tshuvot is watching the Tzitz Eliezer deal with people whose observance is clearly, if anything, way below what it should be, and yet he's dealing with it in halachic terms. So the first case is there were two appeals he got. One was from the 24th of the Nisan. This case had a meetings of the court in Haifa on the 24th of the Nisan of Tufshin Mem Gimel of 1983. The 24th is of Nisan, just after Pesach, Tufshin of 1983, when I was actually in Eretz Yisrael learning in Yeshivat Har Etzion, which is kind of interesting. And then on the 25th of Cheshvan of the following fall, so a few months later, 6 months later, 7 months later, they had an appeal. So on the 25th of Nisan, the Beit Din decided the two sides would get divorced, a divorce, and that there's a joint apartment, and the woman would be allowed to live in the joint apartment for about 3.5 years, till the end of Tufshin Mem Vav, which would have been 1986, so around August, September, when it's Rosh Hashanah's time of 1986, she would have to leave the apartment by then, and then they would sell the apartment and split the proceeds. Now, on the 25th of Cheshvan, and that's why it's the 25th of Cheshvan Tshuva, the court also decided that there were, appeals, and there were discussions, and there were this. They said they got the impression the woman isn't living, this is what the court says, we're going to get to the answer's response in a minute. They said that she's not living a chayim musariyim. She's not living an ethical life. What they mean is, I think, that she's promiscuous, as we'll see. Amnam lefi halacha, but halachically there wasn't enough of a testimony about this issue to obligate a get, but theoretically, if we decided that she's an unfit mother, then it would seem like you would take them, they take the kids away and give them to the husband. But on the other hand, the Beit Din said, but the father's not religious. Now, the mother's probably not religious either, but the point is, you're going to move the kids. They're with the mother right now. You're going to move the kids, and you need some reason to. So if you say the reason is because she's living promiscuously and that's bad for the kids, that's fine, except that the other option is the father, and he's not religious. And the kids want to be with the mother. She's their primary caregiver. Remember, this is the early 1980s. She's certainly their primary caregiver. And there are no claims that she's an unfit mother in the pure physical sense of taking care of the children's physical needs, and probably their emotional needs as well, just not their religious needs. And therefore, the court had said, we decide that you don't move the kids to the father. Now, if the father, if the father, they say, well, I think he had remarried, but if he gets divorced, or if he's remarried, if he gets divorced from this woman, and he fixes himself up, and he comes back to observance, and he gets married again, so then he can claim custody issues. Now, that's a complicated question. It's not really relevant to our tshuva, so I'm just going to throw it out there and leave it. But to think about that question of, if somebody, we're going to see that the husband here is not a great guy, and he has a lot of anger against his wife, and he's willing to say lots of bad things about his wife, you can imagine that somebody would be so crazy that they would undertake observance, live an apparently observant lifestyle with the one big gaping hole that he's only doing to get back his wife and steal his kids back, get remarried to a woman who would be fooled into thinking that he's a really firm guy, maybe even live as a firm guy, and then take the kids away. So that's a challenging question, all those things. Because on the other hand, from a religious perspective, it's certainly true that if the light of Torah and belief in Hashem were to come to him and he were to fix up his life, you sort of would prefer it. So I think these are complicated issues. But moving away from those, Tzitz Eliezer points out there's not really great evidence about this claim that she hasn't acted ethically or morally. The husband comes in as if he wants to obligate her to accept a get, and that if she refuses to accept the get, he wants a heter meir rabbani. He wants to get permission that he should be married, to be able to marry another woman, like a second wife, and not have to worry about a get, because after all, theoretically by halachic standards, men are allowed to marry two women. It's only since the time of, 1100s, 1000, whatever the Chen Rabbinic Kish came out, that Ashkenazim at least don't marry second wives, and therefore there is this thing that you can under certain circumstances, get permission to marry a second wife. And the husband also wants to sell the apartment immediately. This is part of how you see he's not such a great guy. His wife and his ex-wife and children are living there. They need a place to live. No, he wants to sell it right away and force them to move. And he wants all the joint property because he thinks that he's claiming that she shouldn't get anything because she's living promiscuously and terribly and whatever. Now, so before you get around to that discussion, the Stelzer points out that it's an odd thing to say that he's coming to court and saying, I want to force her to get a divorce, because right after the first decision of the court, back in right after Pesach, that early decision, she went to the court and she said, yeah, let's have a get. Right? And on the 16th of Kislev, so this is after the 25th of Cheshvan appeal, on the 16th of Kislev, she announced, the lawyer for the woman, the Ba'i Kocho of the woman, and rabbinic courts aren't supposed to be lawyers, so we have instead his representatives. And that's a problematic situation too, because it ends up being lawyers. You're not supposed to have lawyers for various important reasons, but the people coming representing the wife said, since he's made all these terrible claims against her, he's going to claim that she had affairs, and that she lives, you know, she sleeps around, that she does all these terrible things. Since he's saying all these things about her, she's happy to take a get. She just wants what's coming to her. And that's another important thing, the problem that comes up in getting situations. Very often, one side or the other will try to hold up the other side for money. And then he can't, and they won't ever say, well, I'm holding her up for money. They'll say, this is money that I think is coming to me. And that, because that complicates many divorce situations a lot. This argument about money and what money belongs to who and who should get money, who shouldn't get money. What's important for our purposes is that for all that the husband expressed it a certain way, it's not really a debate here about the get. She's willing to take the get, he's willing to give the get. The get isn't the issue. The question is, he wants to claim that she doesn't have any financial rights. He wants to claim that she's forfeited her financial rights to the ketubah because she's the one who ruined the marriage by having affairs and things like that. So when it's a monetary issue, says to the Ezer, it's a whole different situation that we're about to see. Now, because then you just get into the testimony, because it's just a question of monetary issues. So what kind of testimony do we have that this woman has done anything wrong? So we have the testimony of a detective. But other than the detective, we don't have anything that comes too close to what's called ma'aseh ki'ur. So ma'aseh ki'ur is as opposed to yichud. Yichud is when a woman is seen to be alone, is alone with a man, or I should say, in general, it's a man and a woman who are alone together. In this case, where our issue is this woman, I said a woman alone with a man. It's not that it's more on her than on him, it's that a yichud is, a man and a woman are alone together. Happens to me, it says to the Ezer, the halacha is that just because a wife was found to be alone with a man in a situation which theoretically could have been compromising, that's called yichud, right? Yichud is, we don't have any evidence that anything actually happened. We don't have any evidence that anything didn't happen. We just have evidence that they were alone together. That is not enough for us to say an affair must have happened, and therefore she can't be with her husband, and therefore we force a divorce. That's the halacha. Ain osrin ala yichud. So if the husband only has evidence, and that's what they're just saying, the testimonies we have are only about the fact that she was alone with men. Now, you could say to me, but we know this woman. And of course she this. So that, of course, is not halachic standard. It may be true, but it's not halachic standard. But it may be that we're pretty sure that she's had affairs all over the place. That's not halachic standard. Halachic standard for her to lose the money. Meaning, see, this is talking about, and the truth is, when we say ain't osrin ala yichud, we mean we wouldn't even force a divorce based on this, let alone a money issue. Because if all we know is, now usually it doesn't happen that way. There are very few people, not none, but there are a few people who are so good and so careful about it that you don't see any evidence otherwise. And evidence otherwise, that's what's called dvar ki'or, that we've been ma'aseh ki'or. Ugly things. Ugly things are when we catch them in positions, could be physical positions, but it could also be states of undress even, that would strongly indicate that more than just they're being alone together. Because then the reason why this is an important distinction in halacha is because we only know what we know. That's part of what the situation is going to be pounding as a concept here. We halachically and courts only know what they know. Courts aren't about finding it. They aren't always able to find out all of the truth. Courts are able to find out what they're able to find out, and the rest we have to leave up to Hashem to take care of. So could it be that a woman, you know, dresses completely sneistically, and then occasionally goes into a room alone with a man, and they have an affair, and before they come out, they're both completely composed again, so that all we'll ever know is they had yichud together. But it turns out they're having an affair together. So there, you can have a situation where the husband can say to her, I don't want you ever to go alone with him again. And then, once there's steering, you know, that would be a whole different situation. But if all we know is they went alone together, because on the other hand, it could be they went alone together, right? And all they did was talk. Or all they did was kiss. or all they did was hold hands. Be an odd thing a little bit, because that's not the way people usually work, and it's not good anyway, but it's not the kind of thing that that requires a divorce and that creates financial prejudice in a divorce. So that's the situation that Tzitzit is confronting. So much so that Tzitzit points out that the Beit Shmuel ruled that, let's say a woman had yichud with a man who was not her husband. She was alone with him for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever the amount of time is, 15, an hour. They were alone together. And let's say she did this regularly for a while, and the husband just divorced her. And nothing more was ever proven. We have no more evidence of anything that ever happened. The Beit Shmuel said she could either stay married to her husband if she wanted to. Halachically, if she had an affair, if we know she had an affair, they're not allowed to stay married. And she could, if they got divorced, she could marry the other guy. Halachically, she's not allowed to marry a man she had an affair with. So the Beit Shmuel is saying, we take our lack of knowledge in this situation so seriously that yichud is so little evidence of what else may have happened that we'd even let them marry, stay married, or let her marry the man who putatively she had an affair with. So there are two detectives who said they saw her hanging out with this man outside the house. And there are lots of people talking about her. She's hanging out with this man so much. The woman says that the man's just helping her with her children. Again, she may be lying, but the halacha is we only know what we know. Now, one detective said that he and the husband went up to the house at 1:30 in the morning, and the husband tried to open up the door, and he didn't manage to open the door because it was, you know, like she double locked it, let's say. She barred it or she changed it, whatever. So he banged really loudly, and then all of a sudden she opens the door. She's dressed in a sheer nightgown. And the husband races into the house, and a couple of minutes later, there's screaming and shouting, and another guy runs out of the house when he is half naked, meaning from the top. He's shirtless. Okay, he's bare-chested, whatever the right words would be. And the husband chases after him. So what would that sound like? Sounds like, well, we caught her alone in the apartment, barely dressed, and with a guy who's barely dressed. So, happens to be there's a Gemara, we're not going to get into the story in the Gemara relatively, but the point of the Gemara, story of the Gemara is, the Gemara seems to say that if you find somebody who runs out, that might be evidence that nothing happened, because otherwise he's just hiding. I think it's an odd thing in this case, because it might be the husband found wherever his hiding place was, but in any case, that's a first piece of evidence that we aren't allowed to assume they had an affair, they were having an affair, and that we caught them in the middle. But more than that, the Rush says that all of our discussions about Devar Kiyor, about when we notice them, not just alone together, but in much more compromising situations, so that only is evidence, the Rush had said, when she says, Timea Ani, if she says, I had an affair with the guy. And that means she can't stay married to the husband, and that means all sorts of things. Now, usually we don't believe her when she says, Timea Ani, for two reasons. One is because we don't believe people about incriminating themselves, in general on halacha, if it's going to affect somebody else, right? If somebody wants to only cost themselves something, then we'll believe them, because it's up to them, and that's their right to say things Jewish, not for, but anyway, you leave that aside. Second piece is we don't believe her because Chazal were worried that a woman would claim to have had an affair if she wanted out of a marriage. If the husband was willing to give her a get, she wanted out, she said, I had an affair. And then you can't stay married to me. So we don't generally believe her. So the Rush was saying, but when she says, Tmeya Ani, and you've got some evidence, you've got physical evidence that's pointing in that direction, then maybe believe her. But where she says, I didn't have an affair, everybody agrees that she's allowed to stay with her husband. And she's completely denying that she's having an affair in these situations. She's saying that the whole thing the husband made up, that this whole guy in the house is the husband's guest. He brought the guy to the house, and she says she never really had yichud with him, meaning there are kids in the house. She never went alone into a room with him and locked the door where the kids couldn't get in. She never slept, and not only didn't sleep with him in the sense of having an affair with him, she never slept with him in the sense of sleeping in the same room as him. So you can say, well, but he didn't have a shirt on. So it says, today lots of people walk around without a shirt. It's not a good thing. He calls them the mitpartzim, right? There are people who don't dress appropriately. But there are many men who walk down the street without a shirt. So the fact that the man was in the apartment without a shirt doesn't mean that they were having physical contact with each other. That's just the way people are around. He doesn't say it here, but I think the same could be true of in certain circles of women who walk around in sheer nightgowns. So you'd say, how can you walk around in a sheer nightgown? But certainly today, there are women who walk in the street in something that would be the same thing as a sheer nightgown, right? And you could see their underwear, and they mean it that way. So it's not proof of anything. It's not good, but it's not proof of anything. In fact, he says there's a Shut Mahari Basan who I tried to look up, but I don't remember where he lived. But he said that even if the woman is found walking around without pants, meaning she's in her underwear, literally in her underwear, from the waist down, that would not be a devar kiur enough. That would not be enough of a negative portrayal of herself, of a negative for us to say they must be having an affair. For us to allow ourselves to call that devar kiur, which is enough evidence of an affair to punish her in any financial kind of a way for our belief that she had an affair. And that would be true to Caesar if we had actual witnesses. But in fact, the neighbors don't say that they saw anything. They just saw the man running away. But inside the house, we have no evidence other than of this detective. But this detective, first he says, it's not clear to me that he's a kosher l'edut, that we can accept his testimony, because one of the judges, for example, said it seems fairly clear that his detecting was done on Shabbos. So if he's taking, you know, pictures of things and walking around and hiding and this on Shabbos, then he's being mechal Shabbos, right? And also, he's an employee of the husband's. It's unclear in halacha that if a husband employs somebody to go look at something, if his testimony stands up in Beit Din because he's a nogea by davar, he has a financial stake in his success, and therefore maybe his testimony shouldn't be taken. So again, you have this in American law too. It's not like just on halacha, but I think it's worth pointing out. Courts want to be very careful about certain things. So if I have somebody, you say to me, well, you know, a guy goes and he comes back and he says he saw this, he saw this, he saw this. Maybe he did, but maybe he's lying or stretching the truth because he's got a financial stake in it. And therefore, we wouldn't necessarily accept his testimony either. Also, we have a principle that when we talk about Dvar Kiur, remember, Dvar Kiur is not seeing an affair, it's seeing things that would lead us to believe there's an affair, physical activity that would lead us to believe that an affair is going on. But with an Eid Echad and a Dvar Kiur, we generally assume, so it's the answer, that that doesn't count either. One witness has certain powers in halacha, but not other powers. And in this case, that would not be nearly enough for us to act upon it in terms of separating the couple or in terms of having any financial prejudice against her in the course of the divorce, especially since she's denying it. The husband's certainly not a believer because he's looking for ways to get out of paying her money, and he wants to get more of the financial assets, and therefore and that's why he hired the detectives to begin with. So then one last piece of possibility is the Rambam says if you have a woman who generally just has yichud with non-Jews, so she's called an overet al dat, somebody who violates the general principles of the Torah or of Jewish marriage, and therefore you don't have to pay her ketubah. So it says that might be true, we paskin that way, but you'd need warning with witnesses. You need somebody to say to her, listen, this conduct in which you're engaged can lead you to great financial loss and to losing your marriage, and you need to know that. And without doing that, then she doesn't have to know that yet, and therefore she's not yet an overet al dat. He also points out the Chazon Ish that defines Kiyor as nechnesu l'churva, to a desolate place. L'churva was like, and it used to be, there'd be all these abandoned houses that were falling down and hadn't yet completely fallen down, or Labayit Galmud, or a completely set off place where there's nobody who ever goes in there, and they lock the door, and that means that Vadai Kavanatam Lekiur. It's got to be the kind of evidence of the Chazon Ish where everybody looks at it and says, oh, for sure they were doing it to have an affair. Right, so today it would be like the kind of thing they have to have left work in the middle of the day and gone to a hotel room that rents rooms by the hours and spent an hour there. Right, so that would be maybe that would be key. Right, but that means then that even if we accepted all the detective's testimony here, it's not quite key. Especially since he says, today, there's so many people for whom this conduct, even without any sexual intercourse going on, is ordinary conduct, that there's no reason that we can say to ourselves, oh, it's clearly true, it must be that she's acted in this way, and she's had an affair in such a way that she would lose any money. And then at the very end of the tshuva, he says, somebody said the idea, let's send the woman for a lie detector test and ask her, did you have an affair? So he says, I don't think there's any reason to do that, and he makes a couple of claims here. Some of these claims are practical, and some of them are theoretical. The practical claim is, lie detectors don't work, right? They don't really prove anything fully. So that's the kind of a claim which, even if you accept it, let's say it was true at the time, that could change with time. It could be that one day we'll get a better lie detector test or lie detector technology, and then we would say, oh, maybe we should do. So he says, you know, civil lawyers in non-Jewish courts, they all agree that lie detector tests aren't ironclad, they don't prove anything. But then he says also, Chazal said in Pesachim, that one of the seven things that is always hidden from other people is Mashe b'libo shel chavero. We can never really know what somebody else is thinking. We can think we can know them very well, they can tell us what they're thinking. All that's true, and yet we'll never fully know what they're thinking. So that's the kind of a claim where you say, well, maybe Chazal will write in their time, maybe they're different. But to the Ezra saying, no, I think that it seems to me that that's an absolute principle. And he says, and he comes Then he says, and it's a Torah principle that you need two witnesses to establish things. And that's not fully true, because we just spoke about kior and things like that. There are times when some kinds of circumstantial evidence do provide us some kinds of knowledge that we need. Another example is today, DNA evidence, I think, pretty sure, is used when sadly people pass away in ways that we couldn't identify them fully, and we want, you know, relatives to be able to know what's going on. And very often, if it's a man who has passed away, you want the wife to be able to remarry. So then we all do all sorts of things to where we accept circumstantial evidence, and we don't only rely on testimony. But his point is that when it comes to claiming what another person was thinking or doing, a lie detector can't help us, because we need that kind of thing we need by testimony. And then he points to a midrash, the Gemara, that says that Shlomo HaMelech had thought to judge court cases based on his insight and intuition. He was the wisest man of all time, and the Gemara assumes that he could look at litigants and know who was right and who was wrong, and he thought that he could judge cases based on that, and that a bat call came out, a heavenly voice came out, and said that the Pasuk says in Kohelet, Yosher Divrei Ktov V'chatuv Yosher Divrei Emet, that you should always follow what's written in the true books, meaning the Torah itself, which is Al-Pishnayim Edim. So that Gemara Rosh Hashanah is showing you that we don't rely on things that will tell us what's going on inside of people. And I think that's a very powerful Gemara, because his claim then isn't lie detectors don't work. His claim is lie detectors don't work. But even if lie detectors did work, because that's the Shlomo HaMelech example, nobody said Shlomo HaMelech was wrong because he didn't actually know what was going on. The Torah said Shlomo HaMelech, you can't do it, because the Torah said we do it by eyewitness testimony and not by our thinking we can figure out what's going on in the mind of another person. So that is the first tshuva. And then right close to it, although published in a later volume, was an appeal, and so here the date is really the 28th of Cheshvan, I think, but it was so similar, I don't remember how I came across it, but it's so similar that I almost thought it was the exact same case, but it's really not. So it's also from Haifa. The case started on the 28th of Tammuz of Tufshin Mem Bet of 1982, but then it drags on, because unfortunately one of the things you see when you follow Tshuvot about contentious divorces is that they sadly drag on and on and on, and one side or the other really can very much suffer for it. So, in the 28th of Tammuz, the court decides the woman didn't appear in court, and she sent her representative, and the representative said that she didn't have any witnesses, and that means she doesn't have any proof of her claims, and therefore, since the woman lives with a non-Jew, the court obligates her to accept a get at the first possible time. And if she refuses to accept the get, then, you know, you're going to maybe do a hetzemer rabbanim, and then you're going to, and once they do a hetzemer rabbanim, and then they write a get for her in case she wants it, then you should let him remarry. And there was a minority of the court who said that just because we caught her doing things that were kior, that's not enough to say she can't live with her husband, so that's a minor case. But really the big story in this one is the misconduct of this court, that the Tzitzit Lezer is coming to follow and rule on their conduct. So he says the Psak Din was given purely on the basis of detective's testimony. The woman says that she, and the testimony is that she's living with a non-Jew, she's living with a Muslim, an Arab. I don't know if he's Muslim, an Arab. She's living with a non-Jewish Arab. And she says she's only doing that because she's afraid of her husband, because the husband watches over her, and the husband refuses to live with her husband and wife. And I'm sorry, the husband beats her. And so she ran away from her husband. She's afraid of her husband. She lives with this guy just to protect her. And nothing's happened between them. She says she has it very clearly. Nothing like that. She has her own room. She lives in that room with her children and her mother. Right? So So I don't understand how the original court was so sure that she should get divorced. There's not even a dekir here. There's not even any testimony that she's done anything. The detectives only have testimony that she's living with the guy. One detective never even went into the house, and the one who saw them and went into the house only saw that the guy walks around in his night clothing, whatever that might be, pajamas, let's say, or sweatpants and a t-shirt, and she's in the bathtub, in the bathroom, right? And the guy didn't, and this other detective who was in the apartment didn't check whether the kids are there or the mother's there, right? She claims the kids and the mother live with her in the room, in which case there's no yichud even, let alone kiyur, didn't check. And the Arab had come to the court. Now, it's true that in halacha, a non-Jew's testimony, a non-Jew's believability is very low, but he did come to the court and say, she's got her own room, she's not living with me in the sense of living with me that we're living together. I gave her a place to live because, so apparently in Haifa, in the 80s, Jews and Arabs were friendly enough that this Arab has not has enough sympathy for her that she's gotten either thrown out by her husband or she's afraid of her husband. And that's a piece that doesn't get a lot of discussion here, but you know, you got to open up the possibility that the husband is abusive to her and she was desperate and not observant. She's not firm. She's not a religious woman. So for her, this was an opportunity just to protect herself. So then he points out, and this is where starts getting even worse. There was an original court, right? An original court who thought that, yeah, she shouldn't be forced to get divorced. And they hear the testimony of the detectives, and they said, you know, let's try to get Shalom by. So let's see if we can get the couple back together, because that was, I think it might still be today, but certainly that was the tendency of Batei Din. You don't want to quickly get people to divorce. You want to try to see if they can work it out, because we don't like divorce. We prefer to find ways to help people work it out if we can. And they said she should sign a document that says, I agree to stop living and stop any contact with this non-Jew. And if they're witnesses that I continue living with a non-Jew, then I forgo all of my rights in this marriage, financial, whatever it is. So, and she signed it. On the 19th of Iyar, she signs that document, and she was going to go and try to live again with her husband, try to work it out. And then all of a sudden, the guy... Right, I say it that way because this is right, to the great surprise, the man's representatives come in and say that the husband feels uncomfortable with the current court. He thinks the court is against him. Now, all the court said was, you got this testimony that she's living with a non-Jew, so she's got to stop living with a non-Jew, and she's got to promise that she'll forfeit all of her rights in the marriage if she ever goes back to that non-Jew, and you should try to work it out. His representatives come in court and say he's not happy. Which tells you something about the man. So on the 23rd of Iyar, the Beit Din said, fine, we'll put together a new Beit Din. So that's the 23rd of Iyar. So they make a new Beit Din. They transfer the case to this new Beit Din. On the 27th of Iyar, the new Beit Din issues an injunction against the woman that she can't go into her husband's apartment anymore unless, and they don't make, it's not like they had a new finding of fact. They just took the file, and that's what they said. And their reason was, since the husband says, that she admitted that she did stuff with him, you know, whatever it is, whether or not they actually had relations, but they did masiki, or they did things that would lead us to fear they had an affair, and according to that, the children should go to him, and she starts coming to his apartment, you shouldn't do that. So the titular says, all this is weird. It's Omer Darsheni. You have to figure out, how could this court have done this? So on the 23rd of Kislev of Tavshin Mem Gimel, a few months later, we, the appeals court, were very surprised that in four days, the new court is making decisions without ever looking into it again. And if you've got to remember that the evidence wasn't so great against her to begin with, because the two detectives didn't have any edut lakiyah, they didn't have any testimony that she had done anything that would lead us, in fact, physically, to think that she had an affair. So on the 25th of Cheshvan, this is where it is, this is why we got to the 25th of Cheshvan. On the 25th of Cheshvan of Tavshin Mem Dalet of 1983, we, the appeals court, issued our ruling that the case should go back to the original court. This is so then, just let's point out, two responses on the 25th of Cheshvan, of that meeting of the 25th of Cheshvan, about women who are in these problematic situations and their divorces and how they should work. So we sent the file back to the local court, and we said, you got to look into it again. The local court looked into it again, and they heard just that. One guy came to court and said they had relations. The woman denied it. And then they sent the file back to us without any decision, because that's what we told them to. We said, don't you decide anything. Just do more findings of fact and then send it back to us. So he says, before I get to that, I want to just say the fact that she's living with a non-Jew, which the local court clearly took as evidence, if they're living together, they must be living together in the biblical sense as well. They must be living together, husband and wife, well, they must be having an affair, you know, they must be having sexual intercourse as well. Says, especially with, this is what the scissor throws in, that the court would say to itself, especially with Arabs who were thought to be particularly promiscuous. I think many non-Jews are thought to, in halacha, be particularly promiscuous, and from a halachic perspective, they probably are particularly promiscuous. But the scissor says, I think, kal kalata takanata. There are times in halacha when the fact that somebody or something is already bad means that we don't have to treat it as worse than it is. Because for a lot of people, if they're not observant Jews, if they're not religious Jews, they don't see it as anything wrong. And I think, says that's an amatla for her. It's like an excuse for her. She didn't have a place to live. She's afraid of her husband, especially since many people, I'm sorry, and it's true that many people don't think of it as a big deal. Like she thinks, and she says it. She says she didn't, nothing happened. She says that her original time going to live with this guy was with her, the agreement of her husband, and she says it straight out. So if the husband would have agreed to it, if you can imagine that was true, then it becomes not and no longer evidence of anything on its face. It could be that later on their relationship changed, and in fact it had a sexual component, but you can't prove it. And she points out, and she has evidence, that she got packages from her husband and from his parents, and she was there for a long time, Sorry, I got that completely wrong, and I'd seen it before several times. I always do it wrong. Also, she points out that she got beaten by her husband sometimes. She got beaten by his parents sometimes. And she took a lot of anti-anxiety medication because of her situation. She had no place to go. So when you have that evidence, says Eliezer, then it's not a good thing, but it doesn't prove anything. And then he points out a response to the Chatam Sofer, which is really wild, because the Chatam Sofer, let's remember, lives in the late 1700s, early 1800s, early into the mid. He passed away in 1838, 1839. So he's got a tshuva about a Chazan Akila, the cantor of a congregation, right, who had to go to on a business trip far away. So he goes far away for a while, and while he's gone, his wife takes on as a boarder, let's say, the bass singer, Hamashoir Bas Shalo, to live with her in her apartment, in her house, for a long time. And people were like talking about it. So you'd say to yourself, oh, look at that, she's living with a man. And this is in the 1830s, 1820s, before it's common to live with people. He says, you know, we have no evidence that they plan to have relations with each other, that there was anything promiscuous or sexual about this relationship. It's terrible. He says, Ra'alai Hamas, I don't like it. And it's Ka'ish Kine'or, it's like leading ourselves to temptation. But since he says, and this is, Chassam Sofer is already saying this, since people don't think it's actually us, or meaning when the people of the community were talking about them, what they were talking about was they decided to think that maybe it had turned into a sexual relationship. But the very fact of living together, he says, all the people in that community, they knew about it, and they weren't mocha. It's not like they approached them and said, you can't do this. And this was the time when communal power was strong enough that you could have done such a thing. You could have at least spoken about it. Therefore, he says, you don't have any proof that they committed any kind of a sin. So the Chatam Sofer is not even thinking of it as regalayim ladar, as evidence that would lead us to consider and to assume that it happened, because people don't think that it's prohibitive. If that's true back then, in our generation, says yes, sir, same thing is true, and you can't assume anything, and therefore, you know, again, he takes down the local court for having made their decision so quickly, and that's the decision that he gives. Now, I'm over time already, and I apologize, but there's just a brief postscript by Rav Yosef, who completely agrees with this. They sit on the court together, and also knocks this Beit Din and says, and this is really a problem, but they didn't, that you have sometimes, they said the Beit Din acted, the second Beit Din, who just 4 days later came up with a decision, they said they acted as if they were the representatives of the husband. They did everything the husband said he wanted, based only on the evidence of the husband. How could you do such a thing? So that's a very, very unfortunate and important thing to notice, is that sometimes, sadly, but they didn't go wrong. But also, the other thing I want to point out was, he says, and I want to thank the Tzitzit Eliezer, my friend. They were very good friends. They said about what they did together. They were good friends. So I want to thank my friend, the Tzitzit Eliezer, he says, Rav Eliezer Yehuda of Waldenburg, for reminding us, or for bringing us, the words of the Chatam Sofer. So I found the phrase so interesting, because I don't know what it means, because the Rav Eliezer Yosef at this point is in his early 60s. He's Rav Eliezer Yosef. He's well known for his tremendous breadth of knowledge. So I just wonder if it's true that there was a Chatam Sofer he had forgotten, and the Tzitzit Eliezer pointed out to him. And it's just worth pointing out, but fundamentally, these two examples are examples of where, when Bat Din are going to rule about people and rule about situations, it's their responsibility. And here you see a very responsible judge of a Beit Din taking that responsibility. It's their responsibility to be very sure they know what evidence they do have, what evidence they don't have, and to work out the situation that way, especially when husbands are making claims about women that don't have any backing to them, or don't have a sufficient halachic backing to them, especially when people want to live in the lives they want to. It's a reminder that Bat Din's job is to see what they know, to see what they don't know, and to deal with people as those people are, to the best of their abilities. And that is a responsibility for the 25th of Cheshvan. Have a great day.